It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We explore citizen science, dozens of volunteers in the DNR's rare plant monitoring program, and the work to advance rare plant conservation here in Wisconsin. Share what you wonder about vulnerable species. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kevin Doyle is a botanist with the Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation in the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, coordinating the DNR's Rare Plant Monitoring Program. Kevin, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the clustered broom rape near Lake Michigan. A volunteer found this rare plant. Why was this find such an important discovery?
Yeah, so clustered broom rape is a state threatened plant. It's been found about 9 times in Wisconsin over the last, I don't know, over 100 years. But only 4 of the populations have been seen relatively recently. So like, let's say in the last 40 years. So it's a super rare plant. And it had been searched for, this particular population in Manitowoc had been searched for a number of times without success. And then in 2022, a volunteer named Tom Underwood went out there. He'd looked for it in 2018, without finding it. But sure enough, in 2022, he found it. So it was great news for us, you know, that this population is still around of this really rare plant. But as you can imagine, the kind of information that we can collect in 2022 is much better than we could collect in 1979. So we have GPS coordinates on exactly where the plants were found, which will hopefully make finding it in the future easier, keeping track of it, keeping it out of harm's way, that kind of thing. But then we also have updated information on how is the population doing, what are the threats, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so you're really able to hone in on it. Can you describe what it looks like for us?
Yeah. Cluster broom rape is a small little plant. It gets maybe 6 inches, but I think that would be a pretty big plant. And it's parasitic, so it doesn't produce chlorophyll, so it's not green. It's usually like a maroon to even yellow kind of color. It doesn't have real big leaves. They're more like scales up and down the stem, which again is short. And so it's... as you can imagine, it can be pretty inconspicuous and hard to find. So, which made it even cooler that this volunteer was able to pick it out.
And your volunteer, Tom, had a hunch where to find it. Do volunteers have leads in knowing where to look for these rare plants?
Yeah. So once they take a training and, you know, do a follow-up quiz and sign a confidentiality agreement, we're able to provide them with all the information that we have on where these rare plants are located to help them try to find them. So the focus of the program is to relocate known rare plant populations. And so in order to do that, we have to arm them with maps or GPS coordinates if we have them, or written directions on how to get to these plants. Information on how big the population was, what date it has been found, what the habitat looks like, all that kind of stuff. So whatever we have that would help them in their search, we provide to them.
What is that confidentiality aspect?
So rare species are sensitive. They're often occur in small populations. Maybe they're sensitive to changes in their environment. And so we really want to protect that information. We don't share that information with the public. We only share it to the township level, which is 36 square miles. So we don't share those precise localities with the general public, but with members of this program, because they're helping us relocate these things and are collecting data for us, then we'll provide them with that information. So the confidentiality agreement just says, I'm not going to share this information with the general public.
Okay. Kevin Doyle with us, botanist with the state DNR, as we talk about rare and threatened plants. and the role of citizen scientists who go out and find them as part of the DNR's Rare Plant Monitoring Program. You can join in with your questions at any point at 800-642-1234. Kevin, what is the threshold or the definition of what is a rare plant?
Yeah, so there's legal definitions, like endangered species are defined as those that are at risk of extirpation, so disappearing from the state. Threatened species are species that are at risk of becoming endangered. So there's some legal definition that has to do with how at risk of they are of disappearing from the state. But to put numbers on it, we have 322 species listed as endangered, threatened, or special concern. And if you were to line up the populations of all of them, the average plant has about 10 or fewer populations in the state. So to give people a sense of like how rare is rare, the average plant, so about half of the plants that we have, the half of that 322 have 10 or fewer populations. Now, some have many more. There are some plants like purple milkweed that people might be familiar with. We have like maybe 100 populations documented, but that documentation goes back over 100 years. So there might be a record of purple milkweed from Madison in 1875. You know, the likelihood that that is still there is might be pretty low, but it's still in our database because it helps tell the story of that plant. It helps give us a sense of its historic distribution to see how that might be changing over time, all that kind of stuff. But in general, the most plants have about 10 or fewer populations.
So last year, volunteers went looking for 29 rare plants but couldn't find them. What does that signal?
Yeah, we call these negative reports or negative data when you go out and look for something and don't find it. It could mean a lot of things. And so the kind of data the volunteers collect is really important. So for example, someone could go out and look for a plant, but you know, they were running late. They had some other things to do. They looked for the plant for 20 minutes. They said the habitat looks pretty good, but I just didn't find the plant. That's really different than from someone who went out, crawled around on their hands and knees for 3 hours, didn't find the plant, and the habitat was overrun with invasive species and deer browse was really bad. Those two things tell two different stories. So certainly there are cases of real decline in rare and, to be honest, common plants. I think we all are aware of these stories of species decline. So these negative reports are really important for raising the red flag. What species should we be concerned with? What are these trends? How are these species doing? What are their trends? But it also is important to get the context of each survey so we can identify which ones are likely actual declines and which ones are just the survey didn't have enough time to find the plant.
And if you have about 50 volunteers who all get the same training, are they with you for a duration? Do they spend years with you?
Certainly some do. I think like a lot of volunteer programs, you know, people get involved and they participate for a few years and then they move on to other things. But we certainly have a lot of people that have contributed now for almost 10 years. The program started in 2013. And we definitely have people that have been contributing data, going out on surveys for most of that time. And then new people come in every year too.
Kevin Doyle is a botanist with the Wisconsin DNR coordinating its rare plant monitoring program, documenting the significant rare plant discoveries in the midst of climate change and invasive species. Be part of this conversation. Call in with your questions, your thoughts anytime. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here as we examine highlights of the DNR's rare plant monitoring program and what the discoveries of rare plants mean for the environment and conservation. Join in at any point. Call in with your questions, your comments about vulnerable species, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Botanist Kevin Doyle coordinates the DNR's rare plant monitoring program. Kevin, let's look at another success story from the monitoring program, and that is the Northern Camandra, one of the rarest plants in Wisconsin. What is the status of this plant population?
Yeah, so Northern Camandra, super rare in Wisconsin, state endangered. There's only two populations known in the state, both from Door County. And one of them was relocated last year. So I said with clustered broomrape, that's a parasitic plant. This is a partially parasitic plant. So it does have green leaves, but it also gets a lot of water and nutrients by parasitizing nearby plants. It's related to bastard toadflax, if people are familiar with that prairie plant. There's two populations in the state. One was found in 2022 for the first time in 20 years. So again, it's another example of suddenly we have a lot better information on how the plant is doing. We have precise GPS coordinates, and we have an update on the condition, the vigor of that population. Right now, the DNR is updating our endangered and threatened species list. And part of those assessments to see which species should be endangered and threatened is trends, understanding how the populations increasing, decreasing, are they stable? If they're increasing, how fast? If they're decreasing, how fast? And so we need multiple data points along over these years to interpret trends. And so if a population hasn't been seen in over 20 years, it's really hard or impossible really to assess trends. So the data that we got on that survey in 2022 was really helpful to see this population is pretty stable. It's doing pretty good. I think the other noteworthy thing, or the thing worth mentioning about this Northern Camandra survey was there's only two populations in the state. And I think maybe sometimes people might think like, oh, well, if there's only two populations of a plant, we're probably on top of it. The DNR or the general public has probably visited those populations a number of times because there's only two of them. But that's just not the case. Like I said earlier, are over 320 of these species that we're concerned about. And if you add up all their populations, there's over 6,000 have been documented. And just on public land, there's over 3,000. So that's way more than I can keep up with.
You need your army of volunteers, Kevin.
Correct.
Is there a part of the state that is most abundant with rare or endangered plants?
Good question. There's definitely hot spots around the state. So the corners of the state are usually hot spots because one of the reasons for rare plants being rare is that they're at the edge of their range. So they barely sneak into the state. So Door County is a hot spot. The city of Superior is a hot spot because there's plants that are more common further north, but barely sneak into the northwest corner of the state. And there's a lot of wetlands up there, a lot of really kind of unique wetland types and types of soil. So there's plants there. There's other causes for hotspots are just areas where there's a lot of public land. Mm. So the lower Wisconsin State Riverway in southwest Wisconsin has a lot of public land. And so that provides people with an opportunity to go out and botanize, we would say, or search for these plants. So, there's a number of hotspots. The Baraboo Hills is another hotspot. And then in southeast Wisconsin, the Southern Kettle Moraine is a particular hotspot for, there's a lot of prairie plants and savanna plants found in the Southern Kettle Moraine. So that's a really important spot. And that, again, it's there's a lot of public land down there. And then it's, you know, it's in the crosshairs of Milwaukee and Madison. So there's a lot of people to look for this stuff. That helps. And then on top of that, there's a lot of management going on. There's a lot of groups, whether it's the DNR or the Nature Conservancy or local land trusts, that are actively burning or removing invasive species from a lot of these sites. So it's not perfect, but they're getting a lot of help down there. And that's showing in the number of rare plants we find.
You mentioned invasive species, and I wonder what impact are they having on what makes your list and the future of these rare plants?
Yeah, it's a major concern, a major threat. There's a lot of reasons. Rare plants are rare, but invasive species is certainly one of the biggest. In southern Wisconsin, the problem is probably worse than it is in northern Wisconsin. Not to say that we're not concerned about it in northern Wisconsin, but they've kind of taken hold in southern Wisconsin in a way they haven't quite got to in northern Wisconsin. So yeah, it's a constant battle to preserve these areas. I think historically there might have been a thought that, like, if we just protect the property, if the DNR buys the land or the Nature Conservancy buys the land and turns it into a preserve, then that's great. That's good enough. And I think now we're moving into a second phase where we can't just protect the land. We actually have to manage it and put in the work to remove the invasives and do prescribed fires and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, it's a constant battle. It's habitat degradation is certainly one of the biggest causes of rare species decline, not just rare plants, and invasives are a big part of that degradation.
Big part of that story. Kevin Doyle, who coordinates the DNR's Rare Plant Monitoring Program, giving us insights into what this program is about and the volunteers who help make it happen. You can join in with your questions about rare and threatened plants at 800-642-1234. Kevin, volunteers reported 10 populations of kittentails in Wisconsin, including a new population on private land. What is significant about this plant?
So kittentails is one of the rare plants that's found in the Southern Kettle Moraine that I was just talking about as being a hotspot. Kittentails is what we would call a Midwest endemic plant. So that means it's in across the world, it's only found in the upper Midwest of the United States. And within that small distribution, the Southern Kettle Moraine of Wisconsin is probably the core of the species distribution. So we have more populations in the Southern Kettle Moraine, and those populations are healthier than pretty much anywhere else in the world. So it's a really important species for Wisconsin, and the Southern Kettles are a really important species for it. We call these kind of species responsibility species because Wisconsin, having this sort of outsized number of populations of the species, we have an outsized responsibility to protect them.
I thought I knew what kittentails look like. Can you explain how they look? Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, so the leaves are, they look like plantain leaves.
Yes.
That people might see in their like front yard. So it's not particularly charismatic.
I did a double take, yeah.
Yeah. It's kind of like if people are familiar with Heartleaf Golden Alexander, I'd like to think they're more similar to that because it's a little more flattering than plantain. But and then it has tall stalks of yellow flowers. The whole plant probably doesn't get more than a foot tall, so it's not real big. But yeah, it's kind of these. It looks similar to a plantain.
As we close out here, your program is expanding staff. What will additional staff allow you to accomplish?
Yeah, we're excited that we just hired a second botanist who will help coordinate the program, Jessica Ross. So we're really excited to have her on staff. And I think that will allow us to expand the program in ways we haven't been in the past. So, for example, maybe we'll have more in-person events over the summer, maybe things like kind of group rare plant blitzes where we go to a site where there's a number of rare plants known and we all kind of scatter out working in teams and do that kind of thing. So that'll be good. I think just being able to improve communication, just build capacity on our end to facilitate all these volunteers doing this great work for us to hopefully improve their ability to go out and find these things.
Kevin, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Kevin Doyle is a botanist with the Bureau of Natural Heritage Conservation in the Wisconsin DNR, coordinates the DNR's Rare Plant Monitoring Program. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What a pleasure to have culinary explorer and Minneapolis master chef and restaurateur Yia Vang is here. He uses food to tell stories, believes every dish has a narrative. He hosts the Outdoor Channel's food series called Feral. We'll get into that. Call in about Hmong food, culture, and cooking, 800-642-1234. Yia Vang is a James Beard-nominated chef with roots in central Wisconsin, owns the restaurant Union Hmong Kitchen in Minneapolis. Chef Yia Vang, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, Kate. Thank you so much. So excited. Wisconsin boy, so I'm excited to be on here.
Oh my gosh, we relish you hearing that. You know, you were raised in central Wisconsin. What were family dinners like growing up?
Man, you know, growing up, mom worked second shift, dad worked first. So family dinners most of the time was, my mom giving instruction to us the day before, or, you know, the night before she leaves. And then dad would come home. And he loved watching the news, but he didn't understand English. So he would watch Peter Jennings, Dan Rather. My brother would be watching with him. My brother would help translate. And then me and a few of my other siblings would be in the kitchen kind of, you know, putting things together.
Your family resettled in Wisconsin. You were born in a Thai refugee camp. What did you enjoy eating during your childhood? How did you gravitate to the kitchen?
Yeah. So, you know, to be completely honest, like growing up, we were this, you know, we were Hmong kids. We lived in this little town called Port Edwards, Wisconsin, right by Wisconsin Rapids. And so we were growing up, I've always just wanted to be like the other kids at school. Right. So we would have, you know, like traditional Hmong food at home. And I would pray every day that my parents would allow us to get Lunchables. I would get the Uncrustable, you know, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
That's
I wanted
horrible.
Bologna. Ham and cheese. Like, I go to school and I see my friends with ham and cheese sandwiches and I'm like, that looks amazing. What is that thing? You know, so grass is always greener, you know, and it's because growing up, you didn't want to be that kid that brought like the quote unquote stinky food to, you know, school. So you just wanted to be like the other kids. And so, yeah, that's kind of where my childhood was kind of.
I read about how your mother on Sundays would cook noodles after church, a big pot of noodles. What is the meaning in that? What's a secret to a wonderful pot of noodles?
Yeah. So, you know, so we actually went to the small church up in Stevens Point. So it was about almost half an hour away from where we were living. And so after church, you know, all the congregation, you know, there's about 120, 150 of us. The congregation would just literally say, hey, you know, after church, we're just going to have this cauldron of, you know, stock going on. Faux broth going on, and then everyone just brought, you know, little pieces, like, you know, somebody would bring the noodles, somebody would bring the meat, somebody would bring the herbs, and then after church everyone just grabbed the bowl and we just kind of, you know, faux or kabong in the back, and everyone just kind of, it wasn't like one of those things where everyone just set it up and say, hey, this is kind of like a program. It was just like, this is what we did. And growing up with that, there was this sense of community. But, you know, I was at such a young age, I didn't realize that there was a sense of community. I just thought to myself, hey, like, this is kind of what we do. And it wasn't until, you know, as an adult, it really sank to me that this is something really special. This is something that really kind of forged the foundation of, you know, my worldview.
And that is informing your worldview, but also it's informing your cooking today because you've got Slurp opening up.
Yeah, so we opened up. It's a pop-up restaurant, little area. There's this little kitchen where we use it as our commissary kitchen to, you know, make food for all these other food things we're doing. And there's a little dining area. So we decided that, you know, this is kind of what we wanted to do. And we were very blessed to be able to, you know, put it on. And, you know, in the last, what, 2-3 weeks now, it's been going very, very well. And, you know, it just hits up here, especially with, you know, weather's dropping to negative 30 at times, you know, big bowl of noodle. Yeah.
Hot noodles, cold weather. You're like, that's a win-win in my chef book.
Oh, yeah. Being, you know, Minnesota, Wisconsin, we all know that. And, you know, so we have the people, we have our friends in LA who was like, oh, well, how does that feel like? And I'm like, yeah, it feels like a, you know, when you have that warm, warm bowl of noodles after you're done, you know, I tell people it's like getting a hug from the inside out, you know?
Oh, I love how your name means iron skillet or wok. I wonder if your parents, you know, knew you would find your way to the kitchen as a chef when they named you.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think a lot of, like, Hmong people who, you know, speak our native language, you know, they kind of, you know, they kind of talk about that. But it's really interesting. I actually, my whole life, I've been trying to get out of it, you know, so I never wanted to do this. I always tell people that, you know, food and, you know, kitchen, working in the kitchen, it found me. I tried to push it away. You know, I went to school at UW La Crosse. I graduated with a degree in interpersonal communication, marketing, and PR. And I never wanted to be in this, you know, in the kitchen world. And I kind of just always pushed it away. It was always like a plan. As I always told people, it was like plan D or E. You know, it's like if all this failed, I can always cook somewhere, you know. And and eventually 10 years ago, that really changed, you know, my views really changed on food and understanding that food is the ultimate equalizer. And, you know, it is that universal language we use to speak to each other.
Mm. Well, let me reintroduce you here as we lean into plan A, as we talk about Hmong culture and cuisine with Chef Yia Vang, a James Beard nominated chef with Central Wisconsin roots, telling us about his upbringing with food. You can join in along the way. Your questions for the chef, 800-642-1234. So you own Union Hmong Kitchen in Minneapolis. You're about to open another restaurant. How does a restaurant owner stay competitive and at the same time not get burned out?
Yeah, I mean, Kate, if we can answer that question, you win the $1 million prize, you know. we always talk about how there are some areas where you're going to have, there's going to be sacrifices. You know, it's just pure hard work. I think for me, to be very completely honest, like, I've been very blessed to have great friends and family that, you know, when you do these things, there's going to be critiques, going to be people saying their own thing, they're going to have their own views of what you're doing. And I honestly, my center is, you know, my mom and dad, and they're my shoreline, they're my lighthouse. When everything's stormy outside and I can't figure, I can always look, like, you know, it's so funny, yesterday my mom, I haven't been, they live about half an hour away from where I live, and I haven't been back there in the last week. And, you know, my mom actually just called me yesterday, and she does this once in a while. And she's like, hey, you know, and she has this way of saying that she misses me, where she says, you know, your dad is, you know, he really wants some whole fish. So if you go to the fish market, you can bring back some whole fish. And that's kind of her way of saying, just stop by, you know? And so actually this afternoon I'm going to go grab some whole fish and go visit them. And, you know, that's just, they all mom and dad really wants is just, I just want 5-10 minutes, come by, say hi. Oh. And that to me is so therapeutic, to drive half an hour out there. So it's about basically an hour drive back and forth, you know, and just get to see them for, you know, 5 or 10 minutes. And mama's always, I know you're very busy, I know you have a lot of things going on. But again, also, I just tell people I'm very, very blessed to have a great staff. We have a staff of about 25 people who are incredible operators, who are incredible chefs, you know, and they take care of a lot of details where I can say, hey, I needed a little break. And they're like, we got you. So, yeah.
Let's take a call. Kim is joining us from La Crosse. Kim, hi. What's on your mind?
Good morning. I'm so excited to hear the chef on this morning. I am a huge, huge lover of Hmong food, but I'm quite overwhelmed going into our local Hmong grocery stores, and was wondering if the chef could tell me what are some of the basic herbs, spices that really you know, for broths and stuff, because I just don't even know where to start.
Kim, thank you. What are the basics that Kim should have in her pantry when she's really embracing this food?
Yeah, so this is what I tell people, you know, when you look at it, when you think about the aromatics that we use, and I'm thinking about stuff that's always constantly in my mom's kitchen, right? So if you're talking about aromatics, it's lemongrass, ginger, shallots, garlic. Those are the four aromatics. If you're starting any stir fry, if you're starting any kind of pho broth, if you're starting any kind of soup or anything, those are the four aromatics that you always have to have. You know, and then you go from there. You know, a lot of Hmong food is very herbaceous, you know, so you have your cilantro, you have your Thai basil, which is different from your regular basil. You know, you have your mint and dill. And those are the four herbs that we always have on hand at the restaurant. You know, we're always using that. And we just, it's just commonly known as our herb mix. You know, and then, oh, sorry.
No, go ahead. Keep going. We're jotting all this down. Lemongrass, ginger, shallots, garlic, cilantro, Thai basil, mint.
So, and then to my Wisconsin brothers and sisters, I would say let's turn up the heat a little bit, you know, get some Thai chilies in there. The thing is, don't be afraid. Don't be afraid, because Thai chilies is different from other chilies. Thai chilies, the heat is in the back. So what that means is, like, when you put Thai chilies in something and you're eating, right away you're going to be able to taste all the flavors, the sweetness, the, you know, the savory, and then the heat creeps, you know, a little bit, you know, on you. And I kind of call Thai chili like a ninja chili, you know, so you don't realize it and boom, it's just there. But again, when you're adding chilies into any ingredient, any dish, you remember, less is more, right? You start with a little, you add a little more. And then the two other sauces that have in your pantry all the time, and always put a splash in, is oyster sauce and fish sauce. You know, fish sauce, I tell people, it's kind of like that crazy uncle. You don't want a lot of them at the party, you know, because then it makes the party too overwhelming. But he comes around once a year for Thanksgiving and keeps everything very, very interesting.
I love the storytelling in the food. But what about fish sauce? Because some people, you know, are like, it's okay, but it tastes fishy afterward. What's your advice there?
Absolutely. What I would say is, again, a little goes a long way. You know, like, there's nothing I do that doesn't have fish sauce. For example, when I make chicken noodle soup, I add a dash of fish sauce at the end there. You know, when I do any kind of brothy soup, I always add a dash of fish sauce in there, because it really just, that savory, it just deepens that savoriness. You know, for example, Worcestershire sauce is basically fish sauce, but made in England. Hmm. That's what it is. So, like, you know, people who love Bloody Mary, I say switch out your Worcestershire and add a little fish sauce in there. If you're making house-made barbecue sauce, add a little fish sauce right there. And again, like I said, start with a splash and then taste. The biggest thing is, I mean, I love recipes, don't get me wrong, but the one thing I tell people is, recipe is a guide. It's not the ultimate end. A recipe is a guide. It gives you guidelines. It's those guardrails. But, you know, but if you like it, like, you know, when people go, well, how much garlic? I said, well, how much garlic do you like? You know, some people's garlic level is different from others. You know, well, how much, you know, peppers, how much heat, what's spicy? Well, that's yours, and mine is different. So, yeah, so I tell people, you know, just you put a little in, you taste, you want a little more, taste again.
Kim, thanks so much for the question, the journey on that question, with Chef Yia Vang with us on foods and flavors of Hmong culture and bringing the cuisine of South and Eastern Asia to our palates and the Midwest restaurant scene. Join in with your questions about Hmong food or about the Farrell Show and using invasive species in cooking. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have the host of the Outdoor Channel original series called Farrell and Twin Cities Master Chef Yia Vang on elevating his Hmong family traditions with cooking and sharing stories through food. Still time to talk about Hmong cooking, ingredients you've wondered about. Call in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Chef Yia Vang stays with us. Let's talk a little bit about Farrell and this work of chasing and harvesting and cooking wild game while cameras follow you. What did you enjoy about working on this series?
Yeah, I mean, feral was is a really, really cool concept. About 2 years ago, these producers, Intuitive Content Productions, came to me and said, "Hey, we have this idea, kind of a little crazy, but you know, like, what are your thoughts?" And so, you know, I was like, "Okay, this is, you know, super cool. Let's rock it out." And that's I loved it, because you go in and it's a fun show, but at the end of the day, the heart of it is conservationist. You know, it's about understanding our ecosystem. It's about that there's an imbalance to the ecosystem. And the reason why some of these animals are here is because of us, is as humans. You know, so like, for example, we go down to, you know, the Everglades, and it is infested with, you know, Burmese pythons, and it's destroying the ecosystem down there. Well, the reason why is because all these people wanted these pythons, these pets. And then when they got too big, they didn't know what to do, just throw them outside. And now they've, you know, invaded the Everglades, and they're, you know, so understanding that, looking into that, you know, there, you kind of have this heart for this whole way of saying, how do we bring balance back to our planet? And so, yeah, I mean, that was part of it. But then, you know, you got the other part where you're running through the Everglades trying to catch a python, and I got bit by the python, and that was, you know, kind of interesting. And so, yeah, we were at one point I was like, what am I doing out here?
I thought it was interesting, too, that you approach silver carp as part of the series, because Wisconsin has a silver carp problem, and they're invasive, and they jump, and they hurt boaters and skiers. How do you go about cooking silver carp?
Yeah, so monk families, especially growing up, that was one of the things that we, you know, went fishing for, carp and catfish. You know, and so a lot of times, you know, you could either just, you know, fillet it, and you can, you know, throw it over the fire, grill it, roast it, you know, or you can, again, fillet it, batter it, you know, in cornmeal and deep fry it. And I kid you not, Kate, if you had silver carp the way that we had when we went and we caught silver carp, if you had that, you would never think that it was carp. It literally tasted like a shore lunch. You know, if you're doing walleye, if you're doing sunny, if you're doing, you know, crappie, that's what it literally tastes like. You know, and just knowing how to treat the meat, and just knowing how to, you know, think through it a little bit, and instead of, you know, kind of giving it that bad nomer where it's, oh my gosh, it's a trash fish. But again, a lot of people make their living on catching carp. You know, one of the things they do is they take it to these places where it gets turned into, you know, animal food. It gets turned to dog food, you know, but also it's delicious too. It was, you know, we were doing, and we were deep frying it right on the shore, you know, and it was a little tartar sauce, a little squeeze of lemon, and you would never know.
It changes our thoughts about Friday fish fries, perhaps. Absolutely. Let's take another call. Sarah in Libertyville, Illinois. Sarah, hi.
Hello. I really love lemongrass, and I grew it in my garden this year. I mean, I love the flavor, but this is my first time cooking with it, and I made a Thai pesto with Thai basil and lemongrass and stuff. And, like, how can you – is there any way to make the texture just less – it's, you know, what, I don't even know what the word is. It's just, like, it's, like, really hard. You know what I mean?
Sarah, thank you. Let's get Chef Vang to respond to that. Go ahead.
Yeah, so the word we always use is it's stocky, you know, it always feels like it's fibrous, you know. So for example, lemongrass, depending on the kind of lemongrass you grow, there's some lemongrass that's made just for like stocks, you know, and teas. And then there's some lemongrass where it's a little thicker, right? So the outside layer, you have to peel the outside layer. So it's probably about 2 to 3 layers in. Now, what we do at the restaurant is when we peel that outside layer, we actually don't throw that away. We keep all that quote unquote scrap, and we use it for our stock and our broth, you know. Now, the inside layer is a lot more tender. So I would say when you look at a lemongrass stock, you break it into thirds. You got the top, middle, and then the bottom. Now, the top and the bottom is actually a little stockier. It's a little woodsy, you know, it's a little, you know. So that we, a lot of times we use for stock, and we use for like, you know, teas and stuff like that. Now the middle section, that's where your sweet spot is. You know, if you think about like an artichoke, you know, like you really want to get dig and deep into that, you know, center part where it's a little bit more, it's more tender. And then it's about breaking it down. Like some, a lot of times it's, you know, putting a little oil or a little water in it, and throwing it into like a Vitamix and blitz it up, you know, and you almost turn it into a liquid, you know, so it's breaking it down. And then, you know, the thing I tell about people about lemongrass, if you, you know, break the lemongrass, rub it in your hand and you smell it, it smells like Fruit Loops.
So. I love it. Sarah, thank you. We have Chef Yia Vang, James Beard nominated chef with Central Wisconsin Roots, fielding your questions. Grant sent along an email and asked, what makes Hmong cuisine different from other Southeast Asian cooking like Thai, like Vietnamese and Burmese?
Absolutely. We get asked that all the time. What's the difference between Hmong cuisine and all these other, you know, Southeast Asian cuisines? And, you know, the thing that I say is this, and this is from the last, you know, few years of us really trying to figure out this answer. And I tell people that Hmong food isn't a type of food. It's a philosophy of food. It's a way of thinking about food. Our cultural DNA, the Hmong people, is intricately woven into the foods that we eat. If you want to know where we've been, you want to know where we are and where we're going, you look at our food. Because as a people group, without a state, without a home, without a flag or an anthem, we've always had to constantly be on the move. And as we are on the move, our cultures and other cultures rub shoulders together and we glean from those cultures and forged it into our own. So, you know, for example, the Hmong people in Wisconsin eat a little different than the Hmong people out in Fresno, California. Why? Because of the produce and the product that we can get in Wisconsin is a little different than the produce and the products that we get out in Fresno, California. The Hmong people of, you know, the Pacific Northeast, Portland, Seattle, they eat different than the Hmong people who live down in Boca Raton, Florida. Why? Because we are people from the land. We are people that are agricultural people that that the land is what grows our food. Now, if you just look at the way that growing seasons are in those two cities, it's different. See, the beautiful thing about Hmong people, and I tell people all the time, especially young Hmong people, when I go speak in high schools and middle schools, is that our people have been survivors. No matter where history puts us, we've survived because we believe that by building one generation and giving ourselves to one generation, that builds a platform for the next generation to go. See, my mom and dad, my grandma and grandpa, they were part of this war in Northern Laos, you know, during the Vietnam War. They were part of this war. My dad fought in that war, in the secret war. He sacrificed himself. He gave everything to get us to this country. Now, then he gives us this mantle and says, hey, our generation has given this. What do you do next with it? That's yours now. And I believe that if you really want to know people, you got to know their food. You know, within our company, within our restaurants, we always talk that. Mm. We always say this, that every dish has a narrative. And if you follow that narrative long enough and close enough, you get to the people behind the food. And once you're there, it's actually not about food. It's about people.
Oh.
Now, food is a catalyst to cultivating great relationships. So for us to understand each other, we first start with the food.
Yeah,
and so people always say,
I'm sorry. We're out of time. Thank you for joining us.
No problem.
Yia Vang owns the restaurant Union Hmong Kitchen in Minneapolis. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.